From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Congress is set to vote on a $500 billion spending bill, including $24 billion loan guarantees for the nuclear industry. We'll speak with author Harvey Wasserman. Then FCC Chair Kevin Martin has refused to delay a vote to rewrite media ownership laws that would increase media consolidation, the vote scheduled for tomorrow. We'll host a debate on Venezuela. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Turkish warplanes bombed 10 Kurdish villages in northern Iraq Sunday in what's been described as Turkey's most aggressive action against Kurdish rebels in years. Turkey's military chief said the United States gave the go-ahead for the attacks and opened Iraqi airspace for the bombing raid. Turkish ground forces continue to shell areas of northern Iraq in its fight against the Kurdistan Workers' Party. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan said has threatened to continue attacks on northern Iraq.
Biz hükümet olarak bölücü terör örgütüne karşı.
Our government is determined to use effectively every kind of instrument in the fight against terrorism, political, military, diplomatic, social, and economic. We will continue to wage this battle for our nation's unity and peace, both inside and outside of Turkey.
Turkey has massed up to 100,000 troops backed by tanks, artillery, and military aircraft along the Iraq border. The Iraqi Foreign Ministry said the Turkish bombing raids destroyed hospitals, schools, and bridges. On Capitol Hill, the Democratic-led Senate has authorized another $189 million for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. The Senate approved the spending by a vote of 90-3. The only senators voting against the war funding were Democrats Robert Byrd and Russ Feingold and independent Bernie Sanders. None of the Democratic senators running for president were in Washington for the vote. The bill also expands the size of the U.S. Army by 13,000 soldiers. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports military commanders are seeking more U.S. troops to be sent to Afghanistan. Commanders want several additional battalions, helicopters, and other resources to confront a resurgent Taliban movement. The Washington Post reports President Bush might consider a troop drawdown in Iraq while bulking up force levels in Afghanistan. Attorney General Michael Mukasey is coming under intense criticism by Democrats for his handling of the scandal surrounding the CIA's destruction of hundreds of hours of videotape showing interrogations inside secret CIA prisons. Within a single 24-hour period, the Justice Department warned a federal judge to back off his inquiry into the destruction of the tapes, told Congress to delay its own investigation into the matter, and refused to cooperate with congressional inquiries into the Justice Department's role in the elimination of the tapes. The American Civil Liberties Union called the Justice Department's actions a stunning rebuke of the constitutional system of checks and balances. Meanwhile, on Friday, Senate Republicans blocked a bill that would have required the CIA to adhere to the Army's Field Manual of Interrogations, which bans waterboarding, mock execution, and other forms of torture. The Senate begins debate today on a bill that could permanently expand the government's ability to carry out domestic surveillance and give immunity to telecommunications companies that have assisted in the government's illegal spying. This comes as the New York Times reports the National Security Agency's reliance on telecommunications companies is broader and deeper than ever before. The Times has revealed the NSA has helped the Drug Enforcement Administration collect the phone records of thousands of Americans and others inside the United States who call people in Latin America. The Times also reveals the Bush administration's spy program began almost as soon as it took office, months before the September 11th attacks. A lawyer for an AT&T whistleblower says within 2 weeks of taking office, the Bush administration began a comprehensive effort of spying on Americans' phone usage. In a federal court case, the engineer claims that AT&T sought to create a phone center that would give the NSA access to all the global phone and email traffic that ran through a New Jersey network hub. The International Climate Change Summit in Bali has ended with no new plan to cut greenhouse gas emissions. By the end of the two-week summit, negotiators could only agree to a framework for negotiating a climate change pact over the next 2 years. The United States initially refused to even sign the Bali roadmap, but backed down under intense pressure. The Bush administration was widely criticized throughout the Bali talks for opposing mandatory emissions cuts for developed countries. Friends of the Earth accuse ministers from some industrialized countries of letting down the people of the world. This is Shane Rattenbury of Greenpeace.
Well, look, this afternoon we've seen the climate change talks brought back from the brink of collapse. Unfortunately, the final deal does lack the substance that we would have hoped to see here.
United Nations climate chief Ivo de Boer said some accomplishments were made in Bali.
And also we've taken important decisions on carbon capture and storage to look at technical, legal, policy and financial aspects related to carbon capture and storage. And that, I think, is a critical advance for countries like China and India that will continue to use coal going into the future, but also offers a prospect for oil-producing nations to become part of the solution rather than part of the problem.
In southern Iraq, the British military has turned general control of security matters in Basra province over to Iraqi officials. A recent BBC poll found only 2% of Basra residents felt the British military had a positive impact on the security situation in the southern port. Meanwhile, another Iraqi journalist has been killed. Ali Shafia al-Massawi died on Friday when Iraqi National Guard forces raided his house in Sadr City. He was reportedly shot 31 times. Al-Massawi was a journalist working for the Iraqi video website Alive in Baghdad. In news from Washington, calls are increasing for the impeachment of Vice President Dick Cheney. Three Democratic members of the House Judiciary Committee, Robert Wexler of Florida, Luis Gutierrez of Illinois, and Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, have called on Committee Chair John Conyers to begin impeachment hearings. Robert Wexler said the charges against the vice president are too serious to ignore.
It is time for the House Judiciary Committee to hold impeachment hearings for Vice President Cheney. We have an obligation to ask questions to determine whether, in fact, the vice president purposefully manipulated intelligence, bringing us into war, whether he knowingly ordered the illegal use of torture, whether he knowingly exposed covert agents for political purposes, whether he obstructed federal investigations. These charges are too serious to ignore.
Since last week, more than 70,000 people have signed a petition on Robert Wexler's website supporting impeachment hearings. Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, and John McCain have picked up endorsements from major newspapers in Iowa and Massachusetts. The Des Moines Register backed Clinton in the Democratic race. The Boston Globe, which is widely distributed in New Hampshire, picked Obama. Both newspapers endorsed McCain in the Republican race. In Pakistan, General Pervez Musharraf has lifted emergency rule and restored the constitution less than a month before the January 8th elections. Critics say curbs on the media and a purged judiciary will remain in place. President Bush has spoken out about a report exposing the widespread use of steroids and performance enhancement drugs in Major League Baseball. The president said steroids have sullied the game of baseball.
I think it's best that all of us not jump to any conclusions on individual players' name, but we can jump to this conclusion, that steroids have sullied the game. And players and the owners must take the Mitchell report seriously. I'm confident they will. And my hope is that this report is a part of putting the steroid era of baseball behind us.
President Bush is a former part owner of the Texas Rangers. Four prominent players named in the report played for the Rangers when Bush owned the team: Jose Canseco, Rafael Palmeiro, Juan Gonzalez, and Kevin Brown. In New Orleans, plans to demolish 4,500 units of public housing have been put on hold, at least temporarily. On Saturday, New Orleans police arrested at least three people at a protest outside one of the public housing complexes slated for demolition. Among the arrested was independent filmmaker journalist Rick Rowley of Big Noise Films. Eyewitnesses said police manhandled Rowley, who was filming the nonviolent protest. Police also arrested Sherry Hankla, founder of the Kensington Welfare Rights Union in Philadelphia. The New Orleans City Council is expected to vote Thursday on whether to grant demolition permits at the four public housing sites. And we end today's headlines with news on the passing of three pioneers. Democratic Congressmember Julia Carson of Indiana has died at the age of 69 of lung cancer. She was the first African-American and first woman to represent Indianapolis in Congress. The filmmaker St. Clair Bourne has died following an operation to remove a brain tumor. He was 64 years old. St. Clair Bourne was one of the country's most prominent African-American documentary filmmakers. His works include films about Paul Robeson, Gordon Parks, Amiri Baraka, and John Henrik Clark. And the world-renowned ethnomusicologist Henrietta Yurchenko has died at the age of 91. She was a leading authority on indigenous music of the Americas. She was also a pioneering radio broadcaster who helped popularize the music of Pete Seeger, Woody Guthrie, Lead Belly, and Bob Dylan. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The House is set to vote tomorrow on the $500 billion 2008 Omnibus Appropriations Bill. Unveiled on Sunday, the measure covers budgets for all cabinet departments except the Pentagon. It's expected to pass both houses of Congress this week. Hidden in the bill is a major energy package that would boost government financing for the nuclear industry. It would provide loan guarantees of up to $25 billion for new nuclear reactors. A massive grassroots campaign forced these taxpayer-financed loans out of the National Energy Bill earlier this month. But last week, Republican Senator Pete Domenici of New Mexico slipped them back into the budget vote. Harvey Wasserman has been at the forefront of raising awareness about the dangers of nuclear power. He helped found the grassroots anti-nuke movement in the early 1970s, advises the Nuclear Information Resource Service. He's senior editor of the Ohio-based FreePress.org and editor of NukeFree.org. Harvey Wasserman's also co-authored two books on the 2004 election. They are How the GOP Stole America's 2004 Election and Is Rigging 2008, and What Happened in Ohio, a documentary record of theft and fraud in the 2004 election. Harvey Wasserman is here in New York with me at the Firehouse Studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Great to be with you, Amy.
Talk about this energy bill.
Well, we beat Pete Domenici. With Bonnie Raitt, Jackson Brown, Graham Nash, Keb Moe, Ben Harper, we put out a music video on NukeFree.org. We raised 120,000 signatures and presented them to Congress in October. And Domenici was forced to pull these loan guarantees out of the energy bill, but then slip them back into the appropriations bill. And the nuclear power industry is a 50-year proven failure, and they can't get independent financing to build their own new reactors, which they want to do now. And so they've gone to the government. This is one issue where we're in agreement with Forbes magazine and the Cato Institute, which is backing the opposition to these loan guarantees. Because if nuclear power, after 50 years of huge government subsidies, can't make it in the marketplace, why should the taxpayers fund another $25 billion worth of reactor construction? We're on the brink of a tremendous energy revolution in solar, wind, tidal, geothermal. We're looking almost at a solartopia of a renewable-based economy, which will be much more controllable at the grassroots, much more democratically oriented. And that's why the nuclear power industry is desperately holding on here.
So who are its backers, aside from Pete Domenici?
Well, we have a Westinghouse, General Electric, the usual suspects, Areva, a large French company, all wanting to go into to revive this so-called nuclear renaissance. You know, we've been trying for 50 years to drive the stake through the heart of an industry that doesn't seem to have one. And there's absolutely no demand for new nuclear plants. There's no reason to build them. They don't work. Even with the optimum conditions of licensing and so on, they couldn't get another reactor online for another 10 years. They've been saying the nuclear power plants are a solution to the global warming problem. We know they make global warming worse. It's a total scam. And they're continuing to take taxpayer money, public money, to build reactors where we don't need that kind of financing for wind, for solar, for tidal, geothermal, the other forms of green energy, which can be community controlled. And so these subsidies, these loan guarantees in the appropriations bill, we are asking people through the NukeFree.org website to call Congress, call the congressional leadership, Harry Reid, Nancy Pelosi, David Obie is very key as the congressional chair of the House Appropriations Committee, Mitch McConnell on the Republican side, and tell them, get these loan guarantees out of the appropriations bill.
So talk about how it worked over this last month, went in, went out, went in.
Yes, well, under tremendous pressure with the signatures that we brought in from NukeFree.org to the Congress. We had Ed Markey, John Hall, Shelley Berkley at our press conference. Support from John Edwards, Dennis Kucinich, other key green energy backers. Domenici was forced to pull these subsidies out of the energy bill. It was a very big victory for us. And actually, there were much worse subsidies. There was a loan guarantee for the DOE that was essentially without any congressional appropriations oversight. Now we've got it down to a one-year $25 billion, down to a one-year $25 billion subsidy. But even that's too much, way too much. The nuclear power industry is a terror target just waiting to be hit. We don't need these reactors. They're devastatingly dangerous to the environment. They're destructive of public health. It was shown 40 years ago that regular, so-called normal emissions from nuclear plants kill thousands of Americans every year. This was by the head of the Atomic Energy Commission's own medical research division. So, this is something that is being prolonged at the expense of the public health and the public treasury. The appropriations, as I say, they were pulled out of the energy bill due to public pressure. But Pete Domenici is the senator for nuclear power, and he's very clever at congressional manipulation.
Why is he so wed to nuclear power?
He's the guy. He's been their point guy for decades. You know, he is the senator from New Mexico, and he's been the man that the nuclear power industry has gone to further their interests in Congress.
And he'll be leaving.
He will be leaving, not soon enough, as far as we're concerned. But he's been forcing these appropriations. He tried the farm bill. Now, we beat him on the energy bill. He tried to put him in the farm bill. Then he tried to slip him into the global warming bill, and Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House, pulled him out. We've gotten good support from Senator Pelosi, Senator Reid, and Speaker Pelosi. But we need more from Congressman Obie and from the Republican side. You know, these Republicans are supposedly conservatives, shouldn't be for subsidizing industries like the nuclear power industry. It's an obsolete, proven failure.
What if the nuclear industry doesn't get these loan guarantees?
It's a very big deal. They can't build new nuclear plants. No, Wall Street will not finance new nuclear construction. We are actually in solidarity with the financial community here. Nobody wants to back nuclear power plants. They are a failure. They cannot compete now with wind energy or with solar or tidal or the other green forms of energy, even a flat-out marketplace. And so if they don't get these loan guarantees, they're not going to be building new nuclear plants, and we will be going to wind and solar and to a solartopian, you know, energy vision. So we really, this is a very big deal to stop these appropriations. And, you know, like I say, we're actually in conjunction with the old-time right wing here who actually believes in a free market.
You talk about King Kong madness.
That's right.
That's coal, oil nukes, and gas. The International Climate Change Summit in Bali ended with no new plan to cut greenhouse gas emissions.
Astonishing. It's astonishing. Here they give the Nobel Prize to Al Gore for warning us all about global warming. You know, I'm waiting for Al Gore to get arrested at the Indian Point nuclear plant. That's when he'll really deserve the Nobel Prize. You know, but the power of the coal, oil, nukes, and gas conglomerates, King Kong, as we call them, is astonishing. To have the whole world focused on global warming and then come to this conference and not be able to get even a simple agreement, it's astounding. And it's really a terrifying testimony to the power of these
corporations. Well, Al Gore went there and said, I name the elephant in the room, the United States.
Yes, and, you know, it's a disgrace. It's an embarrassment to the world that the United States would stand. Here we're standing on the brink of a technological revolution that would really parallel the information revolution of the 90s. You know, we had the spread of the Internet, the boom in computerization that really brought us prosperity. We could have a repeat of that if we got away from nuclear power and coal, oil, nukes and gas, and went into green power. But the Bush administration won't let it happen.
How would green power look? I mean, you have the oil companies fighting hard against alternative energy, but at the same time, I mean, like BP calling themselves Beyond Petroleum, at the same time, seeing the writing on the wall, trying to get right in there. Now, there is a way to do this in a centralized way, isn't there? And isn't that what they're trying to get in on?
Yeah, they want to centralize and keep control of their energy supplies, of our energy supplies. And nuclear power is the ultimate way to do that. And then coal, oil, and gas, let them keep control of it.
Even wind and solar.
I think they've realized they can't do it. Solar and wind cannot be centralized the way nukes, coal, and oil can, because they are, by, of essence, decentralized technologies, and they can be community-owned. We're working in Minnesota and other states on a model of community-owned wind power, which we now have $100 million worth of community-owned wind in Minnesota.
Doing what?
Generating cheap electricity owned by the farmers on whose land it is and by the communities that get the electricity. This is the moment of terror for the coal, oil, nukes, and gas industries because they can't control this energy. And if we get, that's why we need to stop these appropriations, because if they can't get the loans to build nuclear plants, all the money is going to go where it belongs, which is to green power. You know, with the information revolution, we didn't have an institutional barrier. With the renewable energy industry and with getting to Solartopia, we do have the institutional barriers of the coal, oil, nukes, and gas industry. And the nuke industry is really the vanguard because it's the ultimate centralized.
And you have some environmentalists who are pushing nukes. They're saying
very,
it's cleaner.
Very, very few. You know, it's been a minuscule. You look at all the money the industry have. They've only been able to pick up a few marginal players. We had a press conference in D.C., and all the major environmental groups were right there. Sierra, League of Conservation Voters, Greenpeace, they're with us. They're, no major environmental group has gone to the dark side.
Where does Bush stand?
You know, in a very deep radioactive hole. We're exactly where you expect. They're pushing, this industry. Actually, Dick Cheney has very serious interests in pushing nuclear power. And, he's been right behind the scenes with Domenici there.
What are his interests?
His interests are very corporate, and he wants controls. You know, the nuclear power, as long as they're putting money into nuclear power, we're not going to get away from coal and nukes and gas. Nuclear power is really the cutting edge for the fossil fuel industry. And if the nuclear barrier breaks, all the new money is going to go to renewables. And so they are terrified. The coal, oil, nuke, and gas industries of renewables. And so nuclear power is really their finger in the dam, because once everything breaks, it's all going to go to renewables, and we'll have a transformed world.
Harvey Wasserman, I want to switch gears and
yes.
ask you about voting. Ohio's top election official, Secretary of State Jennifer Bruner, announced on Friday the voting systems that decided the 2004 election in Ohio were rife with, quote, critical security failures. You and Bob Fitrakis have reported extensively on the 2004 presidential vote in Ohio. Your most recent book, What Happened in Ohio, Documentary Record of Theft and Fraud in the 2004 Election. Your response to the report, what did you think was most important in her findings?
Well, our initial response was yippee. I mean, they finally, after all these years of us banging our, we're local boys, we live in Ohio, Columbus, and we saw the election of 2004 stolen right in front of our faces. And we reported extensively, and everybody laughed at us. And they said, oh, this couldn't happen in America. And we documented and how the GOP stole America's 2004 election and is rigging 2008. We documented scores of ways that this election was stolen. And we pointed out myriad flaws that we saw right in our own neighborhoods of what was done to keep people of color and young people from voting and to rig the vote count. I mean, the servers for the computation of the Ohio vote count were in the same basement in Chattanooga, Tennessee, that housed the servers for the Republican National Committee. The programmers who did the stuff for Ken Blackwell, the Republican Secretary of State, were Republicans who did the websites for the Bush administration. I mean, it's amazing. So here we have, finally, we have a Democratic Secretary of State who spent $1.9 million of state money, hired Battelle, which is not exactly a progressive organization, to study it, and found that every single method of voting, pretty much, except for, marking paper ballots, was corrupted in the 2004 election.
Coming up with opposite results?
Basically what she says was you could have manipulated the 2004 election results with a BlackBerry. The Conyers report basically said all you had to do was drive by with a Wi-Fi. And she comes up and says the very simple ways the 2004 election could have been flipped just like that. And that's what we said for since 2004. Look, this election could have... We are guaranteed certain that John Kerry won Ohio in 2004. The election, the exit polls showed him winning. There was a flip of 6.7% in the exit polls from the official vote count. And, my favorite, in Youngstown and in Franklin County in Columbus, in the inner city, people went in and they hit touchscreen machines and they pushed Kerry and Bush lit up. How do you invent that? How do you make that up? We had votes that were taken away in a county in southeastern Ohio. They proclaimed a Homeland Security alert. Nobody knows where this came from. The FBI, the Homeland Security Agency, they never called a Homeland Security alert.
You mean and suddenly, they locked down?
They locked down. Place. They kept out the media. Suddenly the ballots disappeared. And most importantly, and this Jennifer Bruner did not discuss, I am party to a lawsuit. We filed a civil rights lawsuit. We won. The federal law, election law says the ballots were supposed had to be protected under federal law. We got a overlapping decision from a federal judge to preserve for our civil rights suit the preservation of these ballots. 56 of 88 counties in Ohio destroyed their election ballots. They destroyed all their election records, or most of them, making a pure recount impossible. This is in direct violation of a federal court injunction and standing federal law. So far, nobody has been prosecuted. What kind of country are we living in? Now the Secretary of State comes out with a $1.9 million report and says that all the electronic methods of counting the votes that were used in Ohio in 2004 were easily, that was her word, flipped. Anybody who with a simple electronic machine could have gone in there and turned the election. And we know it was done because the Republican Secretary of State was also co-chair of the Bush-Cheney campaign. How do you top that?
Ken Blackwell.
Yeah, Ken Blackwell.
And what's
gone.
He doing now?
Well, he's out running a multi-million dollar media operation, which is about to benefit from the FCC here. But the
vote of Kevin Martin tomorrow.
Yes, which you're going to talk about in a minute. But the fact is that he's not hurting exactly, but he was defeated.
What company is he running?
I'm not sure what company Ken Blackwell is with now. It could be Blackwater. But at any rate, everything we said has been confirmed. You know, it's a sorry
statement.
What
does this mean for the 2008 elections?
It means that Jennifer Bruner and also Deborah Bowen, you know, in California, has come to similar conclusions and disqualified the electronic voting machines used there. These secretaries of state, if we're going to have an actual election in 2008 that's going to be even reasonably fair, they're going to have a lot of work to do. They have to throw out all the electronic voting machines that were bought with federal money under the Help America Vote Act. You know, after the 2000 debacle, Congress comes in and they say, we're going to solve this problem. So Bob Ney, congressman from Ohio, now in federal prison, says, okay, everybody has to buy touchscreen voting machines. You know, and he gets the money from the touchscreen voting machine companies, winds up in jail. And meanwhile, Ohio spent $100 million, taxpayer money, buying these voting machines. And now Jennifer
From
Bruner,
which company?
Well, from Diebold, from ES&S.
Diebold, an Ohio company.
Diebold's renamed themselves, but Hart InterCivic, all these guys who worked with Jack Abramoff, also in prison. $100 million of our hard-earned tax money went to buy these machines, and now the Secretary of State says, hey, these can't work. They can be flipped like that. And we knew this, and we reported this.
Are you saying our elections are being run from the prisons?
Well, they should. The guys who've been running the elections should be in prison, let's put it that way. But we know, I will guarantee you right here, after all the, you know, I grew up in Columbus, and we saw this election stolen in 2004. And, you know, whether John Kerry should have been president, he won. And Al Gore won in 2000. I mean, where were these guys to stand up for what we were, you know, we were viewed as fringe guys. We never got the slightest bit of help from the Democratic Party. They were apparently too embarrassed to point out.
They're not talking about these issues now.
No, they're not at all. And Jennifer Bruner, we have to give her a lot of credit. The biggest opposition we got to pointing out that the 2004 election was stolen has come from the Democrats. Because who knows? I can't even begin to psychoanalyze them. But the 2004 election was stolen. There is absolutely no doubt about it. A 6.7% shift in exit polls does not happen by chance. And, you know, so finally we have irrefutable confirmation that what we were saying was true and that every piece of the puzzle in the Ohio 2004 election was flawed.
Harvey Wasserman, I want to thank you very much for joining
you,
us, author of a number of books, as well as senior editor of the Ohio-based freepress.org and editor of nukefree.org. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, we go to major events happening in Bolivia, then a debate on Venezuela, and we'll look at the vote on media consolidation that will take place tomorrow at the FCC. Stay with us. We'll be right back. From Los Chacos, Bolivia, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Bolivian President Evo Morales formally received a copy of the country's new draft constitution Saturday as tens of thousands of supporters marched through the capital La Paz. The new constitution would increase the power of Bolivia's indigenous majority, but four of Bolivia's wealthiest regions have declared autonomy in protest of the plans. The four lowland provinces contain much of Bolivia's natural resource wealth and most of its large natural gas deposits. In Santa Cruz, tens of thousands of people marched to celebrate their self-declared autonomy. They object to the new constitution, which would redistribute wealth to the poorer highland areas of Bolivia. Opposition leader and president of Santa Cruz, Civic Committee Branko Marinkovic, spoke at a rally on Saturday.
Señor Presidente,
Mr. President, Evo Morales, stop discrediting this autonomy. I propose you read our statute. I propose you read our statute so that you can realize that this is an autonomy of unity and not of separation.
Meanwhile, President Evo Morales opposed the autonomy move and has vowed to defend Bolivia's unity, saying we're not going to let anyone divide Bolivia. All the legislation has to be submitted to referendums that are expected to take place early next year. Jim Schultz joins us now, executive director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia. He writes a blog on Bolivia that can be found at democracyctr.org. He joins us on the phone from Cochabamba. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jim.
Good morning, Amy. Thank you for having me on.
It's good to have you on. Can you tell us what's happening?
Well, I think as your listeners and viewers know, Bolivia has been going through a huge political transformation for the last year and a half with the election of Evo Morales, the country's first indigenous president. One of the big initiatives that that movement has been pushing has been to rewrite the Constitution through a constituent assembly elected by the people just over a year ago to rewrite the nation's Magna Carta. And that's all come to a head in the last few weeks. And the opposition to Morales and Mas has worked for over a year to try to sidetrack that process. They don't want most of the things that Morales has been pushing for and that Mas and the indigenous groups have been pushing for in that constitution. The meetings that were held in Sucre were disrupted to the point where for 2 months the Constituent Assembly wasn't able to meet. Finally, the backers of Morales and Mas actually met in a military facility behind police guards to initially approve a constitution in a session that the opposition boycotted. All of this has just snowballed into what we have this last weekend, which you described, which is the highland areas where the support for the new constitution is very strong, delivered the constitution symbolically to Evo and Morales in La Paz, and the lowlands where opposition to Morales is equally strong on the other side have declared autonomy. It's about a lot of issues all at once. It's about race. There's certainly a racial divide between the highlands and the lowlands. It's about oil and gas. By the luck of geology, the oil and gas wealth in the country is in the eastern lowlands, and the people in the highlands where there isn't oil and gas want that to be a national resource, and the people in the lowlands, in the same way that you see in Chad or Cameron or all over the world, are looking for the oil and gas to be within their control. So it's about race, it's about power, it's about oil and gas, It's about regional divisions, and it's all come to a head in this endgame over the new Constitution.
Well, with these four areas declaring autonomy, do you see the breakup, a possible breakup of Bolivia?
I think that there's certainly a fear of that here. I think that's unlikely. I think that there's a lot of tension. I think that there's some very hard negotiations to happen in this country. But remember, Bolivian politics always plays out in two forums at the same time. It always plays out simultaneously in political institutions and negotiation and on the streets as people flex their street muscle. I think there are two big issues that autonomy relates to. One is land and one is oil and gas. On land, I think that the autonomy movement is potentially very strong. I mean, the national government is not going to send in troops to enforce land reform. So I think the autonomists there really have a strong hand to play. On the other hand, the oil and gas contracts that Bolivia has are largely with the governments of Brazil and Argentina. You know, the governments of Brazil and Argentina are not going to suddenly cut side deals with these conservative governments in Santa Cruz to deliver the gas and oil revenue. So that revenue is still going to go through the national government.
Jim Schultz, are any foreign governments or corporations backing these four states declaring autonomy?
Well, certainly overtly they're not. There's always suspicions here that there are some foreign oil companies with their hands in the movement to try to get more autonomy for these eastern regions. But again, the players are the governments of Argentina and Brazil. I think it's highly unlikely that Lula is running around behind the scenes to try to topple the Morales government or weaken it. There's certainly always, you know, conspiracy theories here about whether the U.S. government and the U.S. embassy has a hand in this, and Morales has certainly made that accusation. My experience with the U.S. embassy here is that they're a lot more incompetent than they are conspiratorial.
And the draft constitution, what does it give to the indigenous people of Bolivia?
Well, it's very important for the indigenous people here in a lot of ways. And it's important to remember, Amy, that this dream of a new constitution and of a constituent assembly did not get born with Evo Morales, and it did not get born in 2005. This goes back two decades with this vision of, you know, really trying to write a constitution that rises above the history of colonization here. So for the first time, this constitution recognizes the 36 indigenous peoples that are a part of Bolivia. It includes things like the recognition of community justice, in which indigenous pueblos in the highlands, for example, instead of bringing cases of theft and that kind of thing to a court system far away, communities can have systems of justice where people have to make amends through helping build a school or that kind of thing. It also grants other kinds of autonomy to indigenous communities so that people, for example, can elect their leadership through traditional means as opposed to just adopting a quote-unquote Western model.
And so what happens now with the draft constitution?
Well, we're going to have a lot of elections in 2008, that's for sure. The draft constitution has to go to a vote of the people. It has to be approved by a majority of 50% plus one. There will be a separate article of the constitution that did not receive the approval of the full assembly needed, that's on land reform. That will be voted on. As part of the standoff between the regions, President Morales has called for a referendum in which there would be an up or down vote on whether he and the governors would continue in office past 2008. So I think we're headed for an awful lot of elections. I frankly think that the MAS government is in a politically weak position to win approval of this constitution.
Jim Schultz, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Executive Director of the Democracy Center in Cochabamba, Bolivia, writing a blog on Bolivia that can be found at democracyctr.org. This is Democracy Now. Thank you very much. When we come back, we're going to have a debate on what's happening right now in Venezuela. Then we'll find out what's happening with a vote on media consolidation at the FCC tomorrow. Stay with us.
esas tólidas que nos quieren mandar. Levantemos para siempre la espalda, destrocemos el látigo que nos quiere marcar. Campesino por tu propia tierra, obrero por tu propia fábrica, estudiante por tu propia idea. Busquemos lo que ha de emancipar. Sequemos el sudor de nuestra frente y busquemos tras las nubes.
Hasta de hipocresía. That's by Ali Primera here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, as we turn to a key Bolivian ally, Venezuela. Earlier this month, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez was handed his first electoral loss since winning the presidency 7 years ago. Chavez narrowly lost a controversial referendum on 69 proposed changes to the Constitution. They included measures to eliminate presidential term limits, create forms of communal property, and cut the workday from 8 to 6 hours. Turnout was lower than expected. Addressing his supporters a few days after the election, Chavez conceded defeat in the referendum, said he'd leave office in 2012.
I have to leave the government in the year 2012. I have to go. You did not approve the reforms. Well, I have to go. I have to go.
World leaders were largely positive about the election's outcome. Many praised President Chavez for respecting the choice of his voters. President Bush used the opportunity to urge a free trade deal with Colombia. But Bolivian President Evo Morales and former Argentine President Néstor Kirchner lauded Chavez for his democratic qualities.
I respect and value Chavez very much. He's democratic. If he were authoritarian, he would impose what he thinks to govern. But his desire is to consider the Venezuelan people, and Venezuelan people make democratic decisions. That must be respected, and here we don't have to be afraid of a referendum. The people can decide the fate of the country.
With the attitude he's had towards Argentina, and that today he's lost an election, he's shown himself to be a great Democrat by accepting the results.
The Venezuelan people rejected one-man rule. They voted for democracy. And the United States can make a difference in South America in terms of Venezuelan influence. And here's how. The Congress can pass a free trade agreement with Colombia.
And that was President Bush's reaction. Today we host a debate on the constitutional reform referendum held in Venezuela. Gregory Wilpert is with us, editor of the website VenezuelaAnalysis.com. And he's author of the book Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, The History and Policies of the Chavez Government. He's speaking at the Breck Forum tonight in New York, joining us in our Firehouse studio. We welcome you, Greg Wilpert.
Thank you very much.
We're also joined on the phone by Francisco Rodriguez, chief economist of the Venezuelan National Assembly from 2000 to 2004, assistant professor of economics and Latin American studies at Wesleyan University in Connecticut. Francisco Rodriguez joins us on the phone from Middletown, Connecticut. Welcome, Professor Rodriguez. It's good to have you with us. Your response, you are returning to Venezuela. You were just there, Greg. To what has taken place, the defeat of what Chavez was hoping for, to stay in office longer, although many other provisions as well of the Constitution got defeated.
Well, actually, I think what happened is, in many ways, an opportunity for the Bolivarian movement. That is, if this reform had actually won, it would have been very likely that the opposition would have launched a number of efforts to destabilize the country, would have launched violent demonstrations and things like that, claiming fraud. There's some rumors that there were T-shirts already printed that claimed fraud. And that would have made actually governing much more difficult for President Chavez. Now that he won, he lost the referendum, though, he looks much more democratic than people claimed in the past. And so this is a real opportunity for him to actually implement many of the reforms that were in the constitutional reform, but that don't require a constitutional amendment. So, for example, lowering the work week is possible, introducing a Social Security fund, introducing non-discrimination against on the basis of sexual orientation.
Those that doesn't have to be approved by constitutional amendment?
No, many of those things don't. And actually, they said that they will implement, for example, one of the first things is the Social Security fund for self-employed and for informal workers. So so you can move ahead with a large part of his agenda much more social peace in the country.
Francisco Rodriguez, your response to the defeat of Chavez on these issues and how he accepted them. Professor Rodriguez?
Yes, hello, I'm sorry. First of all, I think I'd like to say that I agree that this is a great opportunity for the Chavez administration to be more inclusive, to be more democratic, to finally recognize that there's a large fraction of the population, which indeed in this referendum was a majority of Venezuelan voters, that do not agree with its project of society and to try to call for a government of national unity. Regrettably, Chavez has been very ambivalent about doing this and very contradictory. It's true that he rapidly recognized the results on the night of the election, and that was seen as a good sign by just about everybody, and I believe it was a very good sign. But it's also true that just a couple of days later, he publicly went on national TV before the armed forces and referred to the opposition victory with an adjective, which is an expletive, which I think that we'd have a lot of trouble, actually, if I were to say it on U.S. television. But nevertheless, because of the power of the Venezuelan presidency, this in the middle of the day, this was carried to all Venezuelan households. There has been, just to give you an example, the Minister of the Interior, Pedro Carreño, made the following statement just a few days ago. He said, there is no possible reconciliation because our project for reconciliation was in the constitutional reform. So in other words, if we lose, there's no reconciliation. So I think that what's happening is, again, that the Venezuelan government, the Chavez administration, has a fundamental discourse of dividing Venezuelan society between those who are with them and those who are against them. And I think that
Professor Rodriguez, you're actually comparing Chavez to Bush here? If you are not with us, you are against us?
I'm sorry, I did not hear the question.
I was making a joke, but are you comparing Chavez to Bush here? If you are not with us, you are against us.
I did not. If you're asking whether I made a particular comparison, I did not. I did say that Chavez has a discourse in which he has many times actually repeated that phrase, if you're not with me, you're against me. If you're voting against the constitutional reform, you're voting for George W. Bush. He made the statement publicly during the campaign. So it's a very divisive discourse, and it's a discourse with which the majority of Venezuelan people have shown that they're not identified. So, and I think that if Chavez does not present an inclusive discourse that can include all Venezuelans, then there are going to keep on being problems of governability, and I think that what we've seen in the referendum is the first expression of that.
Gregory Wilpert, your response.
Well, several things. I mean, for one thing, it's been often said that Chavez is being contradictory because he was reconciling, being conciliatory, and then, qualified the victory of the opposition with this negative adjective. But one has to understand in what circumstances he did that. I mean, he did that because the opposition started arguing that that they actually had won by a much larger margin than what was made public. And so Chavez was upset because this was, the Venezuelan elections are totally transparent. I mean, and there was no shred of evidence or proof of any sort that there was any fighting business. But yet there were a whole bunch of rumors going around and newspaper articles claiming that Chavez negotiated the result to make it look closer than it really was. And so he was angry about that, and I think that's relatively understandable that, here they are winning and still claiming, oh, we actually won by a much larger margin and they still cheated us. And he was, being graceful about the result. The other thing is, the whole thing about reconciliation, I'm not really sure what there is often to reconcile about. On the one hand, you have a sector of the opposition that wants to get rid of Chavez by any means necessary, whether it's violence or whatever, and you cannot reconcile with that. But on the other hand, Chavez has often said, he wants to be more inclusive and wants to, as long as the opposition plays the Democratic game. So far, many times they've shown that they're not. When they are playing the Democratic game, I think reconciliation, of course, is always good, and you want democratic debate and participation, but it's not always possible. And so that's why it appears like a contradiction, but you just have to recognize, you know, what's going on in the specific case.
Before we wrap up, Greg, you've been living for years in Venezuela. You've come now to the United States. What do you think are the greatest misunderstandings people here have of what's happening now in Venezuela?
Well, I think the greatest misunderstanding is this idea that the Chavez government is non-democratic or something like that. After all, Chavez has won now 11 out of 12 national elections in the past 9 years. The opposition has had full freedom of speech. And so I think this notion that there's somehow a violation of human rights and so on, I think that's very problematic. I mean, it doesn't bear with the facts. On the other hand, there are problems, of course. The government isn't perfect, and I think one has to recognize some of the problems that exist in Venezuela, but they're not these kinds of ones, problems that are talked about here usually, which have to do with lack of democracy or lack of human rights.
What are the problems?
Well, I think there's an overemphasis on the role of Chavez, that is a very strong concentration of the movement on Chavez, the person. That is a problem. I think it makes criticism within the movement very difficult, self-reflection. That's actually one of the good things about the loss of the referendum, is that now it has forced a lot of self-reflection about what is going wrong in the Bolivarian project that previously wasn't really possible. I mean, that's one. And then there's, of course, the old tradition in Venezuela of patronage and clientelism, which has continued to some extent in the Chavez presidency, and there's not enough recognition of that within the government.
Finally, Professor Rodriguez, your response?
Well, yes, I think that there are a set of problems right now in Venezuela, and particularly the management of the economy is dismal. In the midst of the oil boom, the country actually has rampant inflation. Inflation in the month of November was 4.4%. The scarcity of the basic goods, of the primary consumption basket of poor individuals. I think that you also have to understand that in Venezuela, there have been significant amounts of political persecution. The opposition, one of its main goals, the opposition has supported Social Security reform and has indeed asked the president to approve it even before going to a constitutional referendum, because a constitutional change was not necessary for it. But the opposition is asking, and I think that a great sign by President Chavez for the release of political prisoners that are currently held by the Venezuelan government, of prisoners such as former Finance Minister Francisco Guzman, who's in jail for treason for speaking to a TV program about the death of some soldiers. This government published a list of 3.5 million voters who signed for the recall referendum petition. These voters were thrown out of their jobs. They have been persecuted economically. The government itself, Chavez himself, has recognized that this happened. The denunciations that were made in the press, when there's a free press, you have to accept that there are going to be rumors published in the press. A very respectable Spanish newspaper, actually El Mundo, this morning in Spain, comes out with a very lengthy report on the military pressures that existed on Chavez to actually recognize the results. So these are quite credible stories, and I think that in a country in which there's a free press, the government should be able to recognize it and discuss these things that are going on.
Francisco Rodriguez, we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank you for being with us, professor at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, and Greg Wilpert. His book is called Changing Venezuela by Taking Power. He heads back to Venezuela this week. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we end up on the Federal Communications Commission. Its chair, Kevin Martin, has refused to delay a vote on his proposed changes to media ownership laws. Martin would increase media consolidation by relaxing the rules for companies seeking to own both a newspaper and television or radio station in the same city. The vote is set for Tuesday. The FCC chair says he suggested a, quote, relatively minor loosening of the ban on newspaper broadcasts across ownership. But there's been a groundswell of public opposition to his proposal. Last Tuesday, the Senate Commerce Committee unanimously voted to block the FCC's December 18th vote. But 2 days later, Martin insisted on moving forward with the vote during a heated exchange with Senator John Kerry at the committee's oversight hearing. Craig Aaron joins us now, communications director at Free Press, a national media reform group. He joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Craig.
Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me on.
Craig, what do you expect to happen tomorrow?
Well, I'll say there's a lot that could happen in the next 24 hours. All indications are that Kevin Martin is going to be defiant, ignore the millions and millions of Americans who have contacted the FCC and Congress since 2003, opposing any rule changes that would lead to more media consolidation, going against the wishes of the Senate, which, as you said, a couple weeks ago passed a bill out of committee, the Media Ownership Act of 2007, that would force a fair process, some accountability. Martin appears to be heading down the road to a vote. However, a lot can happen in 24 hours. The last time the FCC met, they didn't start their meeting to nearly 11 p.m. at night. So there are negotiations going on, but Martin appears to be, again, going against the popular will, going against what the public wants, to give a big giveaway to a small handful of the biggest media companies.
The previous chair, Michael Powell, son of Colin Powell, was fiercely rebuked by people across the political spectrum for trying to increase media consolidation. Ultimately, he left and talked about the power he did not expect of the people responding. Why is Kevin Martin, the current chair, doing this?
Well, I think we're heading into the last year of the Bush administration, and there were probably promises made along the way that this rule change was going to be one of the priorities. Time is running out. We're heading into a lame duck administration. They're also hoping to push forward, really, before that same kind of public opposition can come together again. You know, nearly 3 million people contacted the FCC and Congress in 2003, like you say, from across the political spectrum. Commissioner Michael Copps likes to joke that he didn't know that 3 million people knew what the FCC was. So we saw this incredible groundswell of public opposition. It's beginning to stir again. We have hundreds of thousands of comments filed at the FCC, tens of thousands of calls going into Congress. And I think Kevin Martin is trying to rush through these rules by the end of the year before even more people find out what he's up to.
Craig Aaron, who benefits from the media ownership rules changes?
Well, the companies that really want to see this change are companies that already own TV stations and newspapers in different markets. So it's companies like the Tribune Company, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, Gannett. They're the ones who have been calling for this change for a long time. They're the ones who own stations and newspapers in these markets, the top 20 markets that Martin has laid out. But the fact is that all of these big media companies would benefit because there are giant loopholes in Martin's proposal that would allow more concentration, more consolidation in hundreds and hundreds of markets across the country. So it is a small handful of media giants that are going to benefit at the expense of the few remaining independent voices in the local news market, as at the expense of the few women and minority owners who tend to own a smaller number of stations or single stations who are going to be targeted if this rule is pushed through with these giant loopholes.
Now, last time the rule was pushed through, but then it was fought back, and you had groups like Prometheus in Philadelphia actually stopping the implementation of the rule changes through lawsuit. What about here? What happens after tomorrow?
Well, the fight is far from over. Even if the FCC does vote these rules, the last time they tried to pass these, the Senate did actually vote what's called a resolution of disapproval. It's a rarely used Senate veto or a congressional veto. It actually passed the Senate, did not pass the House, but came very close in 2003 before these rules, including this cross-ownership rule, were thrown out by the courts. So whatever Kevin Martin does tomorrow at the FCC, it is very likely that you will see action from Congress. In fact, that's why we're urging people to contact their senators today, trying to put in 100,000 calls to the Senate today and go to stopbigmedia.com to find out all the information. If he passes these rules, there's no question that there will be lawsuits. It will go to court. It's very likely that you could see both public interest groups taking action, as well as the industry, which doesn't think in some ways these rules go far enough. They're also threatening to sue. So it's very likely that this will head back to the courts. And in fact, the appeals court that threw out these rules last time in the Prometheus case would have to review any decision.
Craig,
and we've been collecting. Sure, Amy.
Thanks very much for joining us. Have to leave it there. The end of the show is upon us. Craig Aaron of Free Press. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shufo de Caduce, Aaron Mate, Anjali Kam, Jeffrey Hagerman, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Ricardo Lobo, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Noguera, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley and Hani Masood. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.